Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This morning, Donald Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, gave damning testimony to the House Oversight Committee. He said, quote, Donald Trump had no desire to lead this nation. He never expected to win the primary. He never expected to win the general election. The campaign for him was always a marketing attorney opportunity. He said, I'm ashamed that I chose to take part in concealing Mr. Trump's illicit acts rather than listening to my own conscience. I am ashamed because I know what Mr. Trump is. He's a racist. He's a con man. He's a cheat, end quote. Joining us to talk about the testimony and what this all means is Craig Unger, contributing editor at Vanity Fair and the author of House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. Hi, Craig. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Craig, before we dive in and talk about the testimony, can you just remind us, who is Michael Cohen? And talk about the first time he lied to Congress.
Well, Michael Cohen was the president's personal lawyer. And he, you know, his involvement in this goes way, way back, more than 35 years, I think, when you look at his ties to various Russian mobsters, his relationship with Felix Sater, who partnered with Trump. And when he testified before Congress last year, he was very much still under Trump's thumb. And as he said again and again today, he was lying to protect Donald Trump. We see the Republicans attacking Cohen for lying again. He pled guilty to perjury. But he perjured himself, and he was lying repeatedly on behalf of President Trump, and now he's come to try to wipe the slate clean, as he says it.
There was so many things that Michael Cohen said that were just damning. What stood out for you, Craig?
Right. Well, there are several new things that I really was unaware of. One is that when Trump, and in truth, some of these are not the biggest crimes of which the president is accused, and there are constraints on his testimony. He is not allowed to talk about certain crimes that are still under investigation by Robert Mueller and by the Southern District of New York. But the new crimes, one of them was concerned, Trump was trying to get loans from Deutsche Bank, the huge German bank, which has been accused of laundering money for the Russian mafia. And in his loan application, he had inflated his net worth. That can be a crime of bank fraud, and it's illegal. And here you have Michael Cohen on national television under oath before Congress saying that Trump did it. Another crime that came out was something we sort of knew about, or we had hinted about, but we've never seen it live on camera, is that Trump had directed the hush fund money to be paid to Stormy Daniels. And Michael Cohen describes how that happens, that Trump makes clear what the outcome is. He doesn't direct you to lie per se, but he says, look, there's nothing about this hush money. There's nothing about Trump-Russia. And Michael Cohen gets the message.
Michael Cohen told the committee that he has documents that are irrefutable. He said he's going to give the committee documents, including a copy of the check that Trump wrote from a personal account to reimburse Cohen for the payments that he made to Stormy Daniels. Talk about the significance of that, Craig, because this is something we've been hearing about for a while now.
Well, I mean, here you have the president. I'm not an expert on campaign finance law, but this gets into that, because you have money that is being the hush money goes to help Trump's chances in the campaign. So here you have $130,000, and Cohen presented a check of $35,000 in which he was being reimbursed for that. He said again under oath that those checks were monthly checks. They were meant to reimburse him for the hush money. So these could be seen as illegal campaign contributions, presumably under campaign finance laws.
What else struck you, Craig? Michael Cohen talked about Trump lying, talked about Trump as a racist. He shared information about conversations he had with Trump. He talked about him lying about taxes. He called him a con man. What about those types of comments? I mean, what do you think is significant about that?
Well, I mean, here you see a real Trump loyalist who's gone to the other side, and I think it becomes clear, I think, to most people that his loyalty to Trump was for his own benefit, and you also get a sense of working for Trump as being somewhat cult-like. That comes out again and again and again, that everything is coming from Trump. He works in a certain way. Michael Cohen says that in being with Trump, felt you were part of something bigger than yourself, and that you were the center of things, and that clearly that became a big, big part of his identity, that he was identified as Trump's fixer, and he took that to heart. And then, of course, he felt cast aside as soon as he was indicted, and now he's flipped.
Today, we're speaking with Craig Unger, contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. This morning, Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's former personal attorney, gave damning testimony to the House Oversight Committee. And let's play a clip from that hearing.
I am ashamed that I chose to take part in concealing Mr. Trump's illicit acts rather than listening to my own conscience. I am ashamed because I know what Mr. Trump is. He is a racist, he is a con man, and he is a cheat. He was a presidential candidate who knew that Roger Stone was talking with Julian Assange about a WikiLeaks drop on the Democratic National Committee emails. And I will explain each in a few moments. I am providing the committee today with several documents, and these include a copy of a check Mr. Trump wrote from his personal bank account after he became president to reimburse me for the hush money payments I made to cover up his affair with an adult film star and to prevent damage to his campaign. Copies of financial statements from 2011, 2012, and 2013 that he gave to such institutions such as Deutsche Bank. A copy of an article with Mr. Trump's handwriting on it that reported on the auction of a portrait of himself that he arranged for the bidder ahead of time and then reimbursed the bidder from the account of his nonprofit charitable foundation, with the picture now hanging in one of his country clubs. And copies of letters I wrote at Mr. Trump's direction that threatened his high school, colleges, and the college board not to release his grades or SAT scores. I hope my appearance here today, my guilty plea, and my work with law enforcement agencies are steps along a path of redemption that will restore faith in me and help this country understand our president better.
That is Donald Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, giving testimony to the House Oversight Committee this morning. Michael Cohen said, quote, "The last time I appeared before Congress, I came to protect Mr. Trump. Today I'm here to tell the truth. I lied to Congress about when Trump stopped negotiating with the Moscow Tower Project in Russia. I stated that we stopped negotiating in January 2016. That was false. Our negotiations continued for months later during the campaign. Trump did not directly tell me to lie to Congress. That's not how he operates," end quote. Craig, final thoughts on this. The testimony is still happening. The Republicans are not really going after the content of what Michael Cohen is providing to the Oversight Committee. They're really going after his character, saying that you are a liar. Why should we believe you? I mean, in many ways, obviously, it's political theater. unlike what we've really seen in the past. I mean, it's kind of shocking what we're seeing this morning. But what do you think is going to be done with all of this information? What's next?
Well, I think there are potential crimes that are being testified to as we watch today. And I think the Republican attacks really haven't done much. I think anyone who's watched Law and Order or other TV crime shows knows that criminals often turn state's evidence, and then it's up to the prosecution to either corroborate or refute what's been said. So Michael Cohen, yes, he did lie in the past. There's no question about that. But he also did bring receipts. One other thing that he brought out that came out in the testimony I thought was really important was he said that the special counsel has information corroborating that Roger Stone and Donald Trump discussed the WikiLeaks dump in advance. And that's one of the few things that really goes to the Trump-Russia scandal, that here, we all remember, of course, Trump on the campaign trail saying, WikiLeaks, if you've got those emails, dump them. Well, here we have information saying that Stone and Trump discussed it, and there was further information that Stone was allegedly directly in touch with Julian Assange of WikiLeaks. So that, if you're looking for a sense of collusion, that is one narrative to follow.
Well, we'll continue to follow this. And Craig, we'd love to have you back on this Friday's Media Roundtable, because I'm really curious to see how the media are going to cover this. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Craig Unger is contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. And Michael Cohen's testimony is online if you would like to read it in its entirety. Coming up after a very short break, we will talk about a recent investigation into sex trafficking in Florida, which led to charges against more than 300 people for soliciting sexual acts. We'll talk about how pervasive this is and what is being done to protect victims. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Last week, Florida officials issued hundreds of arrest warrants after an 8-month multi-agency investigation into spas and massage parlors that exposed an alleged sex trafficking ring. Investigators say women working at the spas lived on site, were not allowed to leave freely, and were forced to have unprotected sex with 8 to 15 men a day. Dozens have been arrested on charges of prostitution or soliciting prostitution. Several people face racketeering charges, and one woman is facing human trafficking charges. Several high-profile men, including John Havens, the former president of Citigroup, and Robert Kraft, the 77-year-old billionaire owner of the New England Patriots, have been charged with soliciting prostitution. Kraft was charged with 2 counts of soliciting prostitution. According to CNN, Kraft faces up to a year in jail if convicted. Kraft will also be required to pay a $5,000 fine, do 100 hours of community service, and attend a class on human trafficking. He will be arraigned in Palm Beach County Court on April 24th. Police say they have placed one victim in a shelter who is cooperating with investigators. Several are incarcerated. It is unclear how many victims there were. So today we're talking about how pervasive this is, what is being done about it, and what resources are available for victims of sex trafficking. Joining me in studio is Sarum Choi. She's a legal advocate with Asian Pacific Islander Legal Outreach, a community-based social justice organization servicing the San Francisco Bay Area. Its anti-trafficking project provides comprehensive wraparound services for victims of human trafficking. They also urge policymakers to expand services, support, and prevention efforts. And Sarum Choi joins us in studio. Hi, Sarum. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. We're also joined by Lynn Brewer, president of the Florida Coalition Against Human Trafficking, an organization that works with community groups, service providers, law enforcement, and the media to combat human trafficking through education, coordination, outreach, and training. Hi, Lynn. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you. I want to start off with you, Lynn, because you are in Florida where this sting operation took place. Officials involved in the investigation have pointed out that this latest investigation really only scratches the surface of the trafficking crisis in this country. The International Labor Organization estimates that about 40 million people live in modern slavery, and that's worldwide. One in four are children. Can you talk about what's happening really just in the United States? How pervasive is sex trafficking?
It goes much deeper than most people even realize or want to think about it. This is not a topic that anyone really wants to address. But Florida, as you probably have figured out in all of your research, is the third highest state within our country, and Southwest Florida is number one within the state of Florida for human trafficking. And this is just the cases that have either been discovered or have been reported. It really has nothing whatsoever to do with the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people that are out there that are totally undiscovered at this point.
We'll talk about the specifics of what happened in Florida and what is happening in other states. But Sarum, what would you add when we're specifically talking about how pervasive sex trafficking is in the United States?
I think, well, I can't really speak for sex trafficking. I think human trafficking occurs in every labor sector, and I think it's very pervasive. It's a heavily underreported crime. And I think a lot of people experience exploitation on a spectrum and can go through an experience where it might fall under the definition, the federal definition of human trafficking. You may not know it, so it's completely underreported, so it's really hard to tell. But it's, I would say ILO is the best resource for the data out there.
And ILO is?
The International Labor Organization.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what happened in Florida. According to reports, the sting uncovered a $20 million human trafficking operation. Women were brought from China with the promise of jobs at massage parlors, and then their passports were taken. They were forced to do sex work. According to tcpalm.com, that's a local paper in Florida, some stayed for days, others for months. None of the victims were allowed to leave on their own. They didn't have their own vehicles, and they generally spoke Mandarin or Cantonese. They did not speak English. They were here on temporary work visas, indebted to the brokers who helped them reach the U.S. They believed that legitimate jobs awaited them. What else can you tell us, Lynn, about what we're learning?
Well, I think the misconception about human trafficking, either sexual or labor, is the fact that these people are all being brought into our country. And the statistics have proven that 87% of human trafficked victims are actually U.S. citizens. However, what we have found in a sting down here about 7.5 months ago now, through the massage parlors, was a lot of the massage parlors do bring over the Asian rim people with promises of jobs. It's a fact, actually, that these people don't have anywhere to go. They have no one to relate to. They don't know the difference. And that's why they are being brought in for mostly the massage parlors, the nail parlors, those types of places.
The Treasure Coast newspapers also adds that leaving legitimate, many came from China on temporary work visas, indebted to the brokers who helped them reach the United States, but believing legitimate jobs awaited them. They were shamed, intimidated, and taught not to speak to law enforcement or immigration officials. Sarum, what really strikes you about what we're learning about what happened in Florida during that crackdown?
So if those facts or if those if what you had said was actually the accounts of the woman experiencing or that was part of the raid, I would say that there are elements of force, fraud, and coercion which would meet the federal definition of human trafficking. So I think Sorry, I don't mean to create dead airspace. I'm trying to wrap all this in my head. So I think there could be trafficking, but I don't know if there's enough information. I believe all the information out right now is maybe based on police accounts or their investigation, but I would really like to hear what the workers are saying themselves about what they've experienced.
Well, so just to let people know where we're getting a lot of this information. Mm-hmm. So William Snyder, sheriff of Martin County, Florida, told NPR that the original tip came in by way of a state healthcare worker. When the worker went in, she noticed suitcases or other indications that perhaps somebody was living in a small storefront. She called the sheriff's office, and then they began an 8-month investigation. The sheriff also said one of the women who were there were treating her as a victim, is in protective custody. She said she was offered a job making money in a nail salon, and before she knew it, she came here and found herself in the trafficking industry in massage parlors. What are your thoughts about Sarum's comment, just in terms of where this information is coming from, Lynn, and how are we getting this information, first of all?
Well, okay, many of the cases take 2-3 years sometimes to put together by all of law enforcement. We're talking Homeland Security, FBI, local, state, federal. So these are not investigations that just spring up overnight. And they usually have a great deal of detail behind them. However, what we have found in our area is that prosecution can often take up to 3, 4, 5 years. So true facts, actual true facts, do not always come to the surface immediately. There's a lot of supposition often, but, you know, they tell you kind of what they want you to hear and what they want published. But through the cases that we've had down here, it is not unusual for them to bring over 50, 100 people to work in these massage parlors and these nail parlors, and they will take them and they will move them around the state and sometimes even out of state, so that they have new resources for their clientele. So these people are treated probably much worse than most cattle in our country.
In this particular case, what happened to the women after this crackdown?
In Florida, obviously, you know, it is part of our job to find the resources for them to have shelter and security and so forth and so on immediately. And then obviously then the law enforcement agencies go through and find out who they can utilize for their court cases and who they cannot use. Often the ones that are illegal are deported. Sometimes they make deals where they, you know, can obtain a green card if they do choose to testify. So it's no one case or not any one particular bust is ever the same.
Right.
There's always so many different legs to it. It's where they are getting all of their people. The one that they did down here in March and 15, span four states.
And when we're talking about Florida specifically, according to local reports, many of the women have not been found. One is in a shelter. Several are incarcerated. And if we're talking about women who were not allowed to leave freely and were forced to have unprotected sex with 8 to 15 men a day, Are you working with law enforcement to offer women shelter, to offer them help if they need it, to offer them just basic resources? I mean, how does that work? If these women haven't been found, where are they? What happens to them?
Some of them melt away and are never found, and others are found later. But yes, as far as resources, that's one of the things that the coalition is made up of. That's why we even started the coalition back in 2005, was to help provide service providers with information and to help victims find the services that they need. We have a really strong group of service providers down here who are very, very dedicated. We have probably at this point, right today, we have about 27, 28 victims that are still in our area that are still doing counseling and trying to find a life for themselves. So that is part of our job is to help them find the services that they need when they need them. And law enforcement here is really one of our major backers. They attend our meetings. There's just a camaraderie here against human trafficking. And I find that we probably, more so than a lot of other states, actually have people who are willing to come together to fight this crime, because it's an ever-increasing crime.
We're going to take a quick break, and then, Sarah, I'll ask you about resources in just a minute. That is Lynn Brewer, president of the Florida Coalition Against Human Trafficking. Sarah Choi is legal advocate with Asian Pacific Islander Legal Outreach. And today we are talking about the human trafficking sting that happened in Florida last week. And we're talking about how pervasive this is and what is being done to really help victims. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss the ongoing teacher strikes happening across the country. Teachers in Oakland have been on strike since last Thursday. They're calling for better pay, smaller class sizes, and expanded supportive services. How are these strikes changing the future of public education? That's tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are talking about sex trafficking. Last week, Florida officials issued hundreds of arrest warrants after a multi-agency investigation into spas and massage parlors that exposed an alleged sex trafficking ring. We're talking about it today with Lynn Brewer, president of the Florida Coalition Against Human Trafficking, and Sarah Choi, legal advocate with Asian Pacific Islander Legal Outreach. And if you have any questions or comments for our guests, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What efforts are active in your community to address human trafficking? If you work with an organization that supports victims of trafficking, you can tell us about it. What needs do you see? You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Sarah, the Asian Pacific Islander Legal Outreach provides comprehensive wraparound services for victims of human trafficking. Can you talk about what you provide and how you find victims?
Sure. So we're talking about resources, and I want to address kind of resources. Well, we're talking about resources after the fact, right? So if someone is removed from a situation and is wanting to be removed from a place of exploitation, what kind of resources do we provide? But I'm also wanting to talk about the resources that were maybe not available for these folks who are put into vulnerable situations. So maybe even for these massage workers, I heard that maybe they were living on site, but did they have housing available? Is it a high, is there a high standard of living in the locations where they were at? Did they have resources for other transferable life skills or something like that? So without talking about kind of the resources that were available and or the resources that were not available that put them in situations of vulnerability, which can happen in any labor sector, frankly. But we're seeing that here with the massage parlor and maybe the cross-section or the intersection with sex work that maybe may have happened there. It's really hard to talk about what kind of resources can we provide, you know. So what we're doing at our agency is we provide legal services. That's our primary agency, and we work with partners in the Bay Area that provide supportive social services. And we try to look for housing. We try to look for some employment or job skills that they may want that are hopefully higher paying than what they were used to. We look for childcare if they have children. You know, we're looking for any sort of support that can offer them a way into self-sufficiency that works for them and the lifestyle that they have. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Can you give us some examples when you were talking about helping them find job opportunities that pay more than what they're used to? How successful are you with that?
It's really hard, actually. And a lot of times, because we actually work with a lot of migrant individuals, right. They don't have the work authorization potentially to find jobs that are maybe not that cannot be exploitative? And when they do get work authorization, like what transferable skills do they have? How do they explain a gap in their life where they were maybe either being trafficked or exploited? Like, how do you explain that to an employer that's looking for someone? What were you doing previous to this? You know,
right.
So it's really hard. So we're trying to connect with a lot of folks who maybe have that access or that resource to provide the supportive skills and training for other jobs.
Lynn, what has been your experience? I mean, let's just visualize for a minute. In these cases, again, according to officials, women from China were promised a job here in the U.S. They came. Investigators say that they were not allowed to leave these spas freely. They were forced to have unprotected sex with 8 to 15 men a day. Clearly a very traumatic experience. I mean, it's hard for most people to even fathom this. What happens after that? You know, how do you help these women find jobs after an experience like that?
Well, it really isn't that simplistic. It's a long, long road. When these people come out, and the people that we have worked with through over the years through our counselors and our psychiatrists and so forth, it's nothing to take 5-6 years just to get back to the point where they can even walk into a restaurant. So what we do is, when someone comes out of this situation, whether it be labor trafficking, sex trafficking, it doesn't really matter. They're all treated horribly. They're all confined in one manner or another. It is modern day slavery, plain, simple, end of story. But what happens is normally we provide an advocate on site at that very moment, which is followed by counselors, but the assessment team between the counselor and the advocate decide what that particular human being is in need of. And of course, obviously, they're all in need of housing immediately. And we have some awesome community partners that work very, very hard to provide that, both for the traffic people under 18 or minors, or those over 18, because there's a large difference in Florida. Anyone under 18 who is found in this type of situation is automatically declared a human trafficked victim. Anyone over 18 then can be prosecuted for prostitution if they are in the sex end. So, you know, the counselors then, between all of the community partners together, it's decided what that individual is in need of, whether it be medical help, whether it be dental help, whether obviously it's always psychological help, housing, education. At that point, then their program is started for them. So it's an individual program for each person.
Lynn, can you talk more about the trauma that you mentioned? I mean, obviously every case is different, but you said for some women it could take years before they're able to step into a restaurant again. Can you talk more about that?
Certainly. Number one, a lot of it has to do with the age in which they were taken. We presently, and I know this sounds horrible, but it is a fact, we presently are working with a young 6-year-old male who was put into the sex industry. So his needs are going to be much different than a young adult or an adult. When they come out, depending on the trauma that they have endured and the number of years that they have endured this, and we're all individual, we all crack at different points, depends on the amount of therapy that they would be receiving or the amount of education that they would be receiving. You can't take a child who was maybe put into any type of human traffic situations at 11 and now they are 16. You can't just take them and throw them back into school. So there's all these things, all the peripheral things that need to be addressed prior to this person even thinking about becoming well. So the curve on the success rate of them becoming healthy and well and human beings that can be back into society is not a short curve.
6 years old?
Yes.
And how did that happen?
Actually, his parents sold him.
Wow. That's Lynn Brewer, president of the Florida Coalition Against Human Trafficking. It's an organization that works with community groups, service providers, law enforcement, and the media to combat human trafficking. We're also joined by Sarum Choi, a legal advocate with Asian Pacific Islander Legal Outreach, a community-based social justice organization serving the San Francisco Bay Area. And today we are talking about sex trafficking after last week's sting in Florida. And if you have any questions or comments for our guests about sex trafficking, if you help victims, work with an organization that's connected to this issue, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Sarum, Lynn was talking about working with law enforcement in Florida. And I know that in California, definitely in the Bay Area and other parts of the country, advocates have been working really hard to ensure that law enforcement does not treat victims as criminals, because that used to happen. They would throw women, girls in jail. And that has shifted in the Bay Area. Is that right? And can you talk about just the hard work that went into that?
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about why I think that changed. And I think not only is there trauma from exploitation and trafficking, but there's also trauma when it comes to these enforcement raids. The kind of circumstances that happen with law enforcement coming in on a situation unannounced or unknowingly, it can be very traumatic for an individual, and also can be experienced as very violent. And also the subsequent maybe detainment, maybe there was some incarceration, maybe subsequent treatment with law enforcement officers in other facilities. So that's also part of the trauma that's built in. And I haven't been in the Bay Area long enough to know kind of the history of how we were able to shift that conversation. But I think there has been a lot of advocates who have heard that from the clients that they've worked with or the folks that they've been serving, and communicating that with law enforcement and saying that, you know, that's not humane. That's very dehumanizing. And we want a better way for folks to feel like they're being supported and to receive the help that they need in terms when it comes to the circumstances that they're in.
Does your organization work with law enforcement?
We do. We do have to report our cases to law enforcement sometimes. SFPD has a trafficking unit and have been very supportive of kind of the work that we do. They also passed a bulletin, I think, last year that we were a part of, an advocacy group for, where they wanted to prioritize safety for sex workers. And what that means is that a sex worker, whether they're there by choice, circumstance, or coercion, so that would include trafficking victims, if they've been a witness to or victim of a violent crime, they can come forward and report that to the police without fear of being arrested. And the DA's office as well, they're saying that they won't prosecute. And so that's something that we're trying to take statewide, and that's very important for anyone that's in an exploitative situation.
Lynn, you touched on this a bit, but what is the situation like in Florida? Women who are caught up in these stings, are they treated as criminals?
Well, I think that we have come a long way over the last 8 years. Part of what we do and what we have experienced is that everyone is starting to put in protocols into place for human trafficked victims. And what we noticed was their protocols are all very good. I mean, they spent a ton of time, I know, researching and coming up with the best program possible. But what has happened is there's always a break between maybe like the ER doctors and the police or the fire department or the EMS. There's always a break. And so a lot of times things don't follow the path that it should follow. And one of the things that we have been doing for several years is educating all first responders and ER doctors and nurses. And we have gotten it to the point now where everyone is starting to understand that if you reach the end of your line and on your protocol, then here's your next step. And that was a hard thing to bring about, because everyone thinks that they have great programs, which they do. It's just they stop at a certain point. Hmm. So I think it was the educational portion, and we're very strong in education, getting people to understand that if you see something, say something, and if you have a protocol, follow your protocol. When your protocol ends, here's somewhere else to call. So we're starting to tie that ribbon around that package.
We have kind of a related question from Howard, who says, how can the average person who goes to a nail salon, for example, reach out to the person providing the service to find out what their situation is like and provide help if needed? Sarah, what would you say?
That's a great question. I feel like when we are just in our everyday life, when we're encountering folks who may be marginalized and be at risk of exploitation, you know, build a relationship with them. We actually don't know the circumstances that they're coming from. If they are being trafficked, there could be severe or dire consequences if we try to call law enforcement or try to, quote, rescue them, if they're being removed from a situation without kind of their consent. There could be consequences to their families, to their livelihood, just sustainability even. So, you know, build a relationship with them, find out, you know, how they are, what's their living, what do they need, what resources do they have. I think it's good to make a connection first.
Right. Mm-hmm. And just to give people an example, this is not connected to sex trafficking, but it is trafficking. This is from the API. Allison looked forward to earning money to support her family. An employment agency in her home country hired her to work in the U.S. for an initial cost of $6,000 to cover paperwork and a fully furnished apartment. Instead, she was forced to live with more than 20 others in a one-bedroom, one-bath apartment. They were paid for their work cleaning homes, but the agency asked for the money back in fees for expenses when the group was involuntarily shipped to different states to work. Even though she and others had work visas and social security numbers, the agency lied and said they could be deported if they told anyone. Allison and others escaped when they heard about the International Rescue Committee and API legal research. So we got this from the API's Facebook page. So Lynn, that is just one example. You could come into contact with people who are trafficked, say at a nail salon, or maybe the woman who's cleaning a home. So how would you answer Howard's question, how to reach out to find out what they're going through and then how to help?
Well, as human beings, we are kind of creatures of habit. So we have a tendency to go back to the same nail salon. We have a tendency to frequent the same restaurants. We have a tendency to kind of have our own little patterns. And we always tell people, look around you. Be aware of what's going on around you. If you go to a nail salon and every time you go in there to get your nails done, everybody in there is different, then there's something 9 chances out of 10 going on. If you can go into a nail salon and maybe once every 6 months they may have someone new join them, but everybody else is still there, that's a pretty stable environment. So it's hard to see always, but normally when people are changed out a lot, then there normally is something to be concerned about. And, you know, you can call the national hotline. You don't have to report your name. You can simply say something just is not right here. And at that point, then the national hotline brings it down to organizations such as ourselves and says, this is what we, you know, have going on, and, you know, this is what we're going to do about it. Law enforcement is now, at this point, brought into this. So we keep working and keep getting everyone to be a team player in this whole effort. And education is the best, especially community education.
Well, thank you for that important question, Howard. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to KDF in Oakland. Hi, KDF. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. I have a question for Ms. Lynn in Florida. A number of the law enforcement men seem to be very conscious and understanding. Is that because you've been working with them, or are they just spiritual people, or how do you explain their unusual feminist consciousness?
Well, it may be a combination effort. I think at least what we've noticed around here is that the all types of law enforcement have been thirsty for the knowledge of how we can work better together. How can we recognize these people? How can we handle these situations? So their own teams have been working on this, as well as the educational programs that we have helped provide for them. So it's a round educational program. And I think that people who come in contact with, whether it be sex trafficked or labor trafficked, when they see the conditions that these people are forced to live in and some of the things that they're forced to do, it has to weigh heavy on their heart. So I think that it's the community that you live in, how to help those communities, and how to work together as a team. And I think that our law enforcement down here has figured that out and are working towards that, because we share knowledge, we help each other grow in this ugly crime.
Well, thank you for calling in, KDF. I want to ask both of you, we don't have much time left, about the investigation and how it resulted in charges related to paying for sex against more than 100 men. Police found some of them by pulling over men driving away from the spas for traffic violations and then asked them if they received sexual services at the spa they just left. This later allowed police to obtain a warrant for video surveillance inside the spas, which they installed under pretense of investigating a bomb threat, according to the New York Times. And of course, Robert Kraft, who his team just won the Super Bowl and he's a billionaire, it's getting a lot of attention because he was one of the men that they have video of. I'm just wondering, Sarim, what are your thoughts about this piece of it? And what are your thoughts about, you know, arresting the clients and how that affects the trafficking victims?
I think there is a general growing a general growing idea that prosecuting or going after the buyers is an effective way to fight trafficking. But what I'm hearing on the ground and from the folks that we work with and partner with is that it actually pushes sex work, which is already illegal, sex work further underground, and then part of sex work, or, you know, part of the community of sex workers is those who may be trafficked, right? And so we're pushing folks who may be engaged in sexual services to more riskier places or more areas of where they can be further vulnerable or further experiencing violence. And so that's not, for us at our agency, we don't feel like that's an effective tool to end trafficking. I think policing in general is not an effective tool to end trafficking because it creates further vulnerability and doesn't tackle the root causes of the vulnerability and exploitation. So that's something we have to, I think, rethink, honestly.
So then how would you address it? I mean, in this case, if you have a health inspector mm-hmm. who saw this and said, according to what she sees and thinks, these women are sleeping on the beds.
Right.
How do you deal with that then?
Right. So that could, I mean, that's probably a labor violation of some sort. So that's, that could mean a labor abuse. But how to effectively address trafficking? I think it comes to stronger labor protections. I think it comes to stronger labor laws where workers' rights are protected, better working hours, especially in the massage industry. There's long working hours and there's really unfair wages that can be there. So it's making sure that those rights are protected. And I think that would create an atmosphere where folks who are working in these places can feel like they're able to negotiate their wages.
What about the women who are brought against their will and are doing this against their will?
Right. So that can happen in any industry. And so, you know, it's hard to say. I can't say that law enforcement would be the effective tool, but I think empowering those that they may be in contact with, so other massage workers or other folks in the industry that are not exploited or not trafficked, they can be the ones to provide the resources or the assistance or the means to get out if they need.
Lynn, what are your thoughts?
Well, I have a little different thought pattern, and this is not just my own personal. I mean, this is things that we talk about all the time as a regional coalition. You wouldn't have sex trafficking if you did not have the purchaser. To let the purchaser walk and to prosecute the trafficked person, there, to me, that just doesn't work well. I mean, if there's no consequences to what they are doing and they know that they're buying another human being for one reason or the other, and we're not just talking massage parlors. I mean, we're talking 4-star, 5-star hotels. We're talking they are everywhere. So if you don't stop people somehow, where's the end going to be?
And Lynn, just quickly, we have about 30 seconds. I'm still just wondering about what happens to these women. Are you going to be in touch with people to find out where did they go? Are they getting help? I mean, do they have their basic needs met? You know, I feel like in a lot of the stories, the women tend to be at the end of the article, and you just don't know what happens to them.
Right. And a lot of them, especially ones who do testify, are given brand new lives. They are given new identities. They are moved from area to area. We move a lot of people out of our area simply because, you know, their trafficker may still be out on bond or still may be part of a larger group that they can still reach that person. But we have some very wonderful success stories of people who have been in human trafficking, have taken the long trip back to, you know, to recovery, and some of them own their own small businesses. A lot of them have been going back to school. They have, you know, procured nice jobs for themselves and are trying to start living the way they would like to live. And many of them, especially some of them that come in from outside our country, have no clue as to what they should be looking for in our country.
Wow. Lynn Brewer is president of the Florida Coalition Against Human Trafficking, and Sarum Choi is legal advocate with Asian Pacific Islander Legal Outreach, a community-based social justice organization serving the San Francisco Bay Area. Lynn and Sarum, thank you for your work. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for bringing us to the forefront. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.